Hello and welcome back to Heights Libraries Podcast, Unpacking 1619, where you can explore the interviews we've collected with scholars from around the country, in which we unpack topics relating to race in America. I'm your host, John Pichet, and I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you here. On this episode, I'm joined by Elizabeth Gillespie McRae, who is the Crichton Sosselman Professor of History at Western Carolina University. We discuss her book, Mothers of Massive Resistance, White Women and the Politics of White Supremacy. Here's our conversation from July 27th, 2022.
Good afternoon. I'm Elizabeth Gillespie McRae. I'm an Associate Professor of History at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. I'm the author of the book, Mothers of Massive Resistance, and I'm interested in the intersections of race, gender, politics, and education in 20th century U.S. history.
Fantastic. And the book, as you said, is Mothers of Massive Resistance, White Women and the Politics of White Supremacy. And could you maybe give us an idea of how you came to write the book and what you hope to accomplish in it?
Well, it was a long time ago that I came to the book. It took me a long time to write it, but I think my initial interest or my initial question was pretty simple and maybe naive at that point. I had been working on anti-suffrage women, so women who were opposed to the 19th Amendment, and had been looking at women's political activism in the American South. And I found that both suffrage and anti-suffrage white women in the American South were sort of obsessed with what the 19th Amendment would do to the relatively recent sort of reign of racial segregation. And it was the suffragists, white suffragists in the South, who promised that their votes would uphold white supremacy and would uphold and reinforce segregation, which seemed, here were what we had considered these sort of political progressives, right, arguing for the expansion of democratic rights as an ability to restrain the rights of other people. And so I just started looking to see if they upheld that promise, and if so, how. So that was the sort of one intellectual kind of path. And the other came from sort of a suspicion that the way we had understood the reign of racial segregation and of white supremacist politics in the United States was too focused on most often male elected officials, that our understanding of how white supremacist politics worked and the sort of entrenched nature of racial inequity in the United States was too focused on a really small group of people. And I guess it just didn't ring true to me that the world, this was in the 1990s, but the world that we were living in at that moment, and all the efforts of African-Americans and Americans of color and their allies to overturn racial segregation and to sort of rid the nation of the vestiges of racial slavery. I mean, their work had been prodigious, and yet it had not reached fruition in many ways, right? We were not yet in an equitable society. And so I kept looking for the people who made that so, right? Who were the people that had set up the obstacles to sort of the democratic promise?
Well, and it's interesting too, in some of the work around that's being published in the last 10 years or so about white women's role in slavery and purchasing and owning, and so this is a continuation of that.
I think Stephanie Jones Rogers' book and mine came out maybe just a year apart, and hers is sort of white women's role, as you know, in the regime of racial slavery in the antebellum South.
And I was interested too, how you kind of define, and especially in the suffragette movement, I guess, this came out of the how motherhood and kind of became the location of this segregationist impulse, and how that really transformed family life, family dynamic, and became a political location, I guess. So maybe if you could kind of talk about how that happened and what that looked like.
Yeah, so I think, and sort of tying back to your first question, I think by the time I finished writing the book, there was sort of three or four kind of major lessons that I had taken from the project and that I hope the book would bring to its readers. Was one that white women were central and substantial participants and of white supremacist politics, and that we had to look locally at sort of these grassroots organizations to understand the persistence of white supremacist politics and racial inequities in American society. And then the third point was that in order to do that, we had to examine motherhood as a political construct, not as a sort of politically neutral fact. And so the idea of motherhood, I think both women on the right and the left who have wielded it, right, have wielded it in ways that the public has sees sort of motherhood as this morally superior platform on which to wage politics, right? And so sometimes it has not been interrogated in the same way that other sort of political constructs have. And you don't have to be a mother, right, to use motherhood as a political construct and to argue that sort of your rights as a mother are sacrosanct and justify all these political positions. And the sort of a related point would be that motherhood has often been understood in the sort of public forum, I think, as this morally superior platform, right? So as a mother, I have this sort of natural like nurturing sense for community, which is one construct of motherhood, but a lot of like the mothers that I wrote about and the people wielding motherhood were not necessarily, just because they cared about their children didn't mean that they cared about your children. And so that the idea that motherhood's been this collective construct, I think, reeks of biological essentialism, but has also made it very difficult for us to understand the sort of development of women's political consciousness and activism, particularly on the right.
Yeah, and while you were saying that, it, you know, motherhood came to the forefront during the George Floyd too. You know, a lot of people said every mother felt that as he was crying out for his mother. So, I mean, that kind of impulse was used by the left. But looking at the right, going back to the 1920s, I was struck too by your first chapter deals with this racial integrity law in Virginia, and how it fell to women because of their biological essentialism, as you say, to kind of locate race. And well, I was very shocked to find out. It was a very tough chapter for me to read.
It was one of the last chapters I wrote too, or one of the last chapters I researched. So I think I was equally shocked by the sort of multiple ways that the Racial Integrity Act relied on women in various walks of life to police racial genealogies. And that once entrenched, that work reached long past the Racial Integrity Act, right? And so even in the 1980s, hospital workers were designating babies' race based on their last names or where the mothers came from, right? Rather than the sort of the parental discussion of racial identity. But yeah, it was a very damaging law, and Virginia Virginia's law became the template for the nation. And I think most people believe that sort of the one drop rule is kind of earlier in American history, but it really proliferates in the 1920s. I don't know what else you want, like if you want some details about how that worked.
That would be great, kind of how the law worked, what it was, and then like the how it was used on the ground, like no marriage licenses, that sort of stuff.
So right in the 1920s, there is this proliferation of sort of race science, right? And that is in quotes, meaning that it wasn't particularly scientific, right? But that's overlapping with the eugenics campaigns, right? And sterilization campaigns, with the discussion of immigration and naturalization and Native American citizenship. So all this discussion is sort of swirling around in the 1920s. And in Virginia, there were a group of people well-educated, sort of politically powerful folks that Anglo-Saxon Organization of America, which thought of themselves as sort of a highbrow KKK, a separate from the KKK, right? More refined. And they became obsessed with passing, right? And so the United States Census had adjusted the definition of racial definitions over the 19th and early 20th century. So it's not a static definition. And there was a designation in the census of mulatto, which could mean white and black, or black and native and Indian in those years, or white and Indian. And in Virginia, this group of people became obsessed that people were claiming Native identities on their way to claiming white identities. And they pushed for the racial formula to change. So rather than historically being one quarter, you know, if one quarter of your ancestors were of your lineage was black, then you were black, and 1/16th, and in Virginia it was 1/12th, I think. I'd have to look back at my notes, but I think it was 1/12th in the early 1900s. And so there was this push to eradicate the sort of fear of passing, and that meant erasing Native American identity and erasing mulatto, right? That you could only be white or black. And so this law passes, the Racial Integrity Act passes in 1924 in Virginia. But if we think about how it's implemented, it can't be implemented, right, on a state level. It has to have local people policing it. And the local people that policed it in Virginia were sort of concentrated in Amherst and Rockbridge County, where there'd been this long, historic group of folks in Irish Creek and on Bear Mountain that were understood to be the descendants of white, black, and Indian families. And so people in those vicinities began to target and move these groups from either mulatto or Native identities into black. And this had lots of consequences. We're in the middle of the Jim Crow era. This meant you couldn't go to school where you were going. It meant the loss of voting rights. It meant the inability to use public services, right? It meant it eliminated you from particular jobs. And so the cost, right, of being moved from Indian or mulatto to black were severe. And but this was done largely by women who would be the registrars, right, when you went to register your marriage, women who were midwives, and most babies were delivered by midwives at this point. Teachers, right? And over 80% of elementary school teachers were women at this point. Social workers. So in the new sort of progressive era bureaucracy, right? We have a lot of women that have moved into careers around like kind of public housekeeping roles. So juvenile delinquency work, social welfare work. And these women became central, right, to policing this line in local communities. And if they didn't do it, it would not have worked, right? There's no way if they didn't report people from their classrooms, if they didn't say, I'm sorry, I think the name Clark means that you're Black, not white, and therefore you can't marry this person. If they hadn't alerted the courthouse to that, the act would not have worked. And so you have this sort of cadre of white women that are policing their neighbors, right? In the bedroom, in the classroom. And then you have sociologists from across the country who come to study these groups of people, and they use young women who are social work students at nearby universities to go out and do what we would call today service learning, right? What universities call is service learning, to go out, right, and do observations and research in these communities. And these women were trained in New York, right, at Cold Springs Harbor, which was the center of eugenics research. And so while my book focuses on this in Virginia, you had women across the country that were trained at Cold Springs Harbor to go out and sort of police mixed race people, right, through public welfare institutions and bureaucracies in the 1920s. And it was scientists saying women have this particular germplasm that allows them to sort of detect racial intermixing. That was not true, right? But clearly. But so you have a whole generation of young women in the new profession of social work that were trained in sort of creating a Jim Crow society.
It was incredibly disturbing to me that the fact that they could change birth certificates after the fact. There are all these like real life examples of how this like a racial designation change could really impact the entire course of your life.
Right, right. And if you watch if you trace in the census, you can see families resisting these changes, right, by moving their children into a neighbor's house who was lighter skinned, by adding an E to their name so they're different than the darker skinned Clarks. I mean, there are all sorts of ways, by being belligerent when the midwife tries to write down your racial designation. And so then the Bureau of Vital Statistics instructed the midwives to write down what the people said, but on the back to make a note so it would be changed in Richmond. So I think we have this whole, we have both the implementation and this sort of underground, or not always underground, resistance to it.
Well, I'd also like to just kind of maybe have you talk a little bit about the fear of passing, because what does that entail, and why was it such a concern?
I'm not sure that I can answer like statistically why it was such a concern, right? But I think in the logic of Jim Crow, right, in the logic of a society based on racial segregation, legal racial segregation in the South, but if we think about it elsewhere, even in sort of real, like real estate and housing and college admission, different places. So the logic of Jim Crow requires you to be one or the other. Right. It diminishes the notion of an individual or a community being multiracial. And so the most dangerous folks in a Jim Crow society are in that liminal space. Right. So the Racial Integrity Act didn't affect sort of well-known Black communities, right? So, which is why in places like Southside Virginia, you didn't see much resistance. You see some, so that's overstated, but you don't see this kind of focus that you do in these communities where interracial families and communities have been for a long time, right? But Jim Crow requires that the line be drawn. And I think in one way, the Racial Integrity Act shows how that line is so make-believe, right? That it took all this cadre of people, right? And all these sort of mental and intellectual gymnastics to sort of make sure that there was a line that did not reflect the reality of people's lives, right? But did reflect the political reality that people were trying to shape.
Yeah, and I think too, where I was thinking as you were talking is it also is kind of the direct result of the one thing that all racists feared at the time, which was this interracial mixing of and producing of children, right? So trying to police that as well. But I kind of like to move into how textbooks and schools became our next location of segregationist, Jim Crow, and then massive resistance. How did that become a woman's place, a political location, I guess?
Right. So, I mean, I think when we often think about the fight against racial segregation and its dismantling, we think of the Brown decision, right, which was about public education. And so the locus of sort of the classroom is central to this larger civil rights story, and it's also central to the story of white supremacist politics. And schools had been a place that, if thinking back to your question about the construct of motherhood, schools had been a place that were seen as a natural extension of the family, right? And were a place where if you are a professional woman, you could get work, right? It was also a career path for women. And so in the 20th century, and so schools are a place where women wielded authority. I mean, when we think of, and you see pictures of the PTA, right, from the 50s or the 60s or the 40s, right? I think most people don't imagine seeing businessmen sitting at the PTA, right? It's mothers with Tupperware dishes. And I think schools were seen as sort of a place that women wielded particular authority because it was a place, right, where children gathered. And in the sort of understanding of traditional gender roles. And it was also a place that I think women saw space, right, to exercise public and political power. And that's across racial boundaries, that's across sort of partisan boundaries, that schools were this extension. And we see that discussion today. Right. If we look at the campaigns against sort of critical race theory, there's all sorts of mother organizations, right, that say, you know, my authority as a mother means that I can control the curriculum or control what my children are taught. And so I think schools become this locus, right, where women can wield authority. And if you think about teaching about citizenship, right, schools are where it's taught. It's where kids say the Pledge of Allegiance. It's where we have these debates about curriculum. And so if you're trying to reproduce or you're trying to entrench a social system and you know it needs work, right? You know it needs people working. That's not like a natural state. You know, it has to be constructed. Then schools are the place to construct it and reproduce it. And the women who are workers, right, who are explicit about this work understand that schools are places where they can train teachers to reproduce white supremacist politics, places where they can control the national textbook narrative about American history, places that they can conduct a kind of reward system like essay contests that produces a certain set of values. And so what you get in Mississippi, even in the 1930s, the Mississippi Educational Association did a study, and they found in 1938, I think, that if a student read every single textbook in every single subject for their entire public school career, they would never meet one single African-American by name. And that was by design, right? That had not been true 40 years ago. That was because of the work that these white women did. While some of their counterparts are building Confederate statues, there's a whole cadre that are working to make sure that this idea of a racial hierarchy is embedded in the public school curriculum.
And I don't think that point can be stressed enough. They're actually, you know, editing the books to erase them on. Yeah. So that.
Right.
I think you mentioned.
Yeah. And so the South, right, which is not seen as a particular, I mean, historically has not been out in the front of educational reform, becomes the first region that does statewide textbook adoption. And by doing that, the sort of the calculus of profit meant that national publishing houses wrote their books to get statewide textbook adoption in the South, which then means that folks all over the country are reading the textbooks that this cadre of white women have shaped for the Jim Crow South, in the same way that sort of Texas and California work today, right? Although I think textbooks aren't as central in a way they were in the early decades of the 20th century.
Yeah, and that's an important point. I think, and then after Brown happens, so we've had this kind of conscious creation of white supremacy curriculum and maintaining, because as you say in the book, this is really where they realize the racism and the segregation is that this is where the white supremacy is going to be taught. So now Brown comes along, and what happens? There's this shift.
Right. So just to backtrack a little, right, in the post-World War II era with the United Nations and their effort to sort of prevent another, genocide, they had pushed their educational wing, kind of multicultural education. And at that moment, what we see across the nation and the people that took the lead in California, for example, saw multicultural education as a threat to American sovereignty. And so at that moment, I mean, it's not a moment, right? But sort of in that era, what we see is the efforts that I had talked about in the Jim Crow South in the pre-war era get a national constituency, right, of conservative white women who are anti the post-colonial independence regimes, who are anti-communist, who are fearful of the United Nations and begin to campaign against multicultural education because they think it diminishes the story of the American founding fathers. And so they become natural allies, right? With this, they are also segregationists, right? Of a different ilk, but segregationists nonetheless. And they become natural allies. And so by the time the Brown decision is handed down in 1954, these really politically astute and active white women across the nation are ready for it. Right, they've known that this is coming. And so they retool, right? They retool their political strategies. And they amplify some that they had tried in the post-war era. So what we see is a shift from sort of explicitly racist, right? Like, yes, white children should never go to school with black children, and you know, this sort of the ugly language of racial hierarchy. We see it shift over the 1950s and 60s. Not that no one is saying ugly things, they are, right? But we see a shift politically to trying out this sort of colorblind language. So instead of talking about, you know, white superiority, they begin to talk about constitutionalism. And instead of talking about oversexed Black boys in the public forum, they talk about family values and parental choice. And segregationists across the country, Southern and other places, had tried out that language, right, in earlier eras. And so they shift, and they're really explicit about this. So the group in California, Pro America, will do this. In Mississippi, an organization starts that's not, I think, is more illustrative than powerful. I mean, it's powerful in some ways, but it's not like the Tea Party or whatever, right? It doesn't have that sort of reach. But the Women for Constitutional Government, and they tell their members, do not talk explicitly about race. Right. Talk about constitutionalism. Talk about mothers of school children. Talk about school choice and family values. Right. Because racism, racial equality is a symptom of a larger problem. And this, the way we fight it is no longer being overtly white supremacist. If we want to build a movement, we have to change our language. And that moves into the new right. And so that's how I think, like, we see the changes over the course of the Brown decision.
Yeah, I kind of think of it as, you know, different codes, because prior to Brown, you can just say the awful thing out loud, and there was enough of a system to support that. Whereas when you get to the after Brown, you have to change the code into what you were talking about, that kind of.
Right, because you've, in some ways, you've lost the national fight, right? In some ways, right? You've got the Civil Rights Act, you have the Voting Rights Act. Like, if we only look top down, right, you're losing, right? And so I think if we look bottom up, we see that the losses are not what we thought they were from the top down.
Yeah, and I kind of wanted to look at the bottom up, because the anti-busing, you know, I was a kid when busing was talked about. And I remember where I live here, it was, we integrated our schools pretty successfully, but in other parts of Cleveland, it was kind of what you were talking about with Boston, and maybe talk about Boston and how mothers and women kind of took the lead on that too.
Yeah, so I think as a result of these decades of national networks, right, and Southern segregationist white women were not sequestered in the Jim Crow South, right? They had organizations and friends and had migrated and had, so they had ties across the nation. And in the early 60s and mid 60s, some of them predict, right, that as sort of racial integration becomes the law of the land, that Northern and Western communities will act in much the same way as Southern communities. And whereas a lot of people outside of the South were for racial integration, right, supported the Brown decision, the numbers are starkly different when you get to anti-busing. But I think this is sort of a code switching too. Right, that the folks who opposed busing at the time, right, in the national narrative, were not called segregationists. They were called anti-bussers. And it was about being able to walk your children to school as a working class mother. It was about property values and neighborhoods. And so they were seen as sort of more sophisticated than the female version of, right, the pickup truck riding, overall wearing, you know, Confederate flag waving Southerner, white Southerner. But the outcome, that they were working for, as Black Bostonians reminded them, was that it's not the bus, it's us, right? Like the outcome was a version of racial segregation. You don't have to have total racial segregation, right? To still have communities that are built on the ideas of racial inequities. And so I think it's been a real disservice to a nation trying to, for those folks in the nation that want a kind of racial reckoning and want to move to racial equality, that we have made massive resistance something that white Southerners do, and that anti-bussers become sort of something different. Right, the anti-bussers came, I mean, they called Charlotte to find out how to do it, right? They asked George Wallace to come into their homes to figure out how to conduct sort of white supremacist campaigns. And they stood outside playgrounds and yelled racist names at elementary school children, right? In scenes reminiscent, right, of Little Rock, of New Orleans, of things like that. And so I think anti-busing should have, I think, exposed a sort of national investment in racial segregation and white supremacist politics. But for a long time, I think the way we told the story masked that.
Well, yeah, and I think part of the problem, and the book kind of touches on this, is that the structural racism of the North was more hidden than the structural racism in the South. So you got this kind of see the apparatus that was at work in the South, and in the North, redlining was a little bit more hidden, you know.
Yeah. Both written into policy, less explicitly written into law. Right. So in the South, we have a legal regime. So you can open up the books and say, you know, you have to use separate Bibles to swear on, right, if you're Black and white. And in the, you know, and you can't vote. And in the North, there were voting rights, but it didn't mean that there wasn't a system of white supremacy embedded in the bureaucracy and in the policies that were enacted.
Well, and I think, yeah, this is all great. And maybe if you could just, I talked to a professor about the Southern Manifesto and Massive Resistance a little bit, but maybe if we could end with kind of where you see, I mean, I think you kind of did with how Massive Resistance was a Southern thing, but it was also Northern. Maybe if you could kind of give us an overview of like where we leave it and how we are today.
Well, you know, my historian answer is, oh, I did all this research on the 20s through the 70s, right? And lots happened since the 70s. So there, a caveat would be my research ended before the insertion of evangelicals into the political sphere, right? So that comes, right, through the period I wrote, and evangelicals were supposed to stay out of the political sphere because it was inherently, right, immoral. and so I think that's a fundamental change. But it is hard today not to see the sort of ripples, right, and see some similarities in the moment we're in today. And the people doing the work and the debates about the 1619 Project and critical race theory and the anti-trans sort of, you know, people slipping into libraries and pulling books out, right? Or people banning books in public libraries. I think it's hard not to draw connections between the kind of work that the women I wrote about did, right, and the kind of work that's being done today. And, you know, somebody could do the study, and I think we would see, right, that the sort of legacies of of segregationists, right? And understanding that segregationists remake themselves, right? Like segregationists are not always only the people putting the signs up, right? Like it is politically sophisticated too, in the ways like Ibram X. Kendi has talked about this, but I think it's hard not to see the connections, and it maybe is helpful to look at how on a local level, right, the women that sustained different versions of racial segregation and were committed to white supremacist politics, how and where they worked in the 20th century is not so far afield from how they're working today. I mean, if we look, the school board seemed to be the locus of a significant political effort by the far right at this point. I mean, I live in a small area in rural Western North Carolina, and our recent school board election, there was a billboard that said Conservative Mothers for Education, and running three women who couched themselves, two white and one woman of color, that couched themselves as sort of anti-CRT and making sure that the curriculum didn't focus too heavily on minorities. They ran for school board, and they were trained and right. They had received training and funding, not just from the local community. And so, and there's a reason for that. There's a really clear reason. And the war waged against public education since the Brown decision, I think we are seeing, you know, the seventh decade, is that eighth decade, right? We're seeing the culmination of a pretty, of a well-oiled effort, right, to sort of erode public education in the United States, which can work both ways, right? Public education can reinforce the status quo, which is what I wrote about, right? But it is also a place of incredible possibility, I think, for opportunity and for democracy. So yeah, I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, I'm trying to get a bunch of people together to talk about vouchers and charter schools and how that kind of ties into all this as well.
So. Yeah, my next project, which is really early on, but I want to look at sort of the history of school and parental choice. And certainly one strand of it comes out of the anti-Brown decision moment, right? The folks opposed to the Brown decision that embraced the mantle of school choice and parental choice. And in the South, that meant segregationist academies. But this notion that public money can be used for exclusive publics, not inclusive, I think we see at that moment, and we've seen the manifestation of that today.
Thanks for listening to Unpacking 1619. For more information on Heights Library 1619 Project Discussion Group, or to check out more interviews with scholars, please visit heightslibrary.org. See you next episode, wherever you listen to podcasts.